Good morning. This week, the fallout from last weekend's rather epic count.
Stay tuned. It's like current affairs Christmas in the newsroom. Morning Ireland is next.
Thank you very much. You're listening to our continuing coverage here on RTE Radio 1 of the results coming into us slowly but surely from last Friday's election.
Yeah, Kevin Boxer, morning, good afternoon. Is the meter running?
The meter is running. Colm is running since 10 past four this morning.
You don't have one vote received until they go into the box. Mm-hmm. If they don't go in, they can't come out.
Harry, is it too early to make a projection?
It's always too early to make a projection.
Funny how geography always is important. Location, location, location. They're saying, you know, I'd be 50 kilometres away from a TD, and that actually means something to people. So even though the county line...
I think it was said to me on Twitter, they were going to write a movie about a young count reporter who was sent up to Cavan Monaghan and was stuck there for
a
rom-com would be there for 3 weeks, fall in love with a teacher there and end up settling in Cavan Monaghan forevermore. So not to put pressure on our count.
We're still counting. There are a lot more seats to be filled. We're going to be here for a while, aren't we? I mean, some of these counts are going to go well into next week, aren't they?
Your coalition partners were pointing the finger at you, and then the people who on the left, you know, people like Labour and the Soc Dems were saying, well, we're green too, and they did steal your clothes, didn't they?
Not in terms of delivery, ever.
There was a very large number of private security personnel there gathering around Gerry Hutch, and it was funny, at one point they were trying to walk him over to Marie Sherlock, the Labour, now TD. He wanted to go congratulate her, and the security were kind of in a circle around him. The media were in a circle around the security. We were all walking really, really slowly. It was more of a shuffle over to Marie Sherlock. I'd say anyone else watching in the count centre, they knew who was in the middle of it, but I'd say they were wondering what was going on. I'd say it was a sight to behold.
It'll get awful confusing, won't it, if there's two Owen O'Briens in the one constituency?
You can never have enough Owen O'Briens, let me tell you. Once you get accustomed to us, but two Owen O'Briens is always better than one.
He'd be reminded perhaps of the old TV cop series Kojak, as he used to remark to his sidekick Stavros, who loves you, baby.
So there you have it. Anyway, Cavan Monaghan, finally, what are we? 27 hours on, we've had a first count in Cavan Monaghan, as we heard. Can I ask you first of all about your own constituency? Looking at the figures in front of me, you seem to be almost there.
So 174 seats have now been filled in what will be the largest Dáil in history. But cobbling together a government based on the current breakdown of party support is expected to take weeks, if not months. And we're here to tell us about the protracted period ahead.
And there you have it, and as Claire put it, the coalition cobbling has begun. Fianna Fáil have 48 seats, Sinn Féin 39, Fine Gael 38. The Greens reduced to just the one. Labour Soc Dems each on 11, and smaller parties and crucially independents making up the sums to get to 174. And on Wednesday, the three largest political parties held their first meeting since the general election. On Drive Time, Sarah gauged the mood, the way forward. First up, the shiny happy people in Fianna Fáil. Here is Niall Collins.
Good evening, Sarah. Well, needless to say, it was a very upbeat meeting. We had it in our parliamentary party room. There was barely standing room or even room for people to sit with our new swelled numbers. And it was great to meet so many new colleagues from around Ireland. So it was a great buzz and I suppose an air of anticipation also.
Happy days there. But given that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have just come out of a coalition government, this from Sarah.
But sure, there's not a whole lot of difference between what yourselves and Fine Gael were proposing in advance of the election.
Well, look, there's plenty of differences, and each party will come to talks, and indeed independents and others. They will all have their own set of policy requirements.
Yeah. But just
policy.
If we stick with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil for a second, like what are the stumbling blocks? I know the VAT rate is one, the 11% VAT rate that Fine Gael were proposing, but that's, you know, I would imagine an easy enough one to deal with. Apart from that, what are the problems?
Well, what you'll have to have is a working majority within Dáil Éireann. So you'll quite possibly have agreement between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, in a matter of weeks. But you have to have, obviously, it's going to need more to form a majority and to form a decent working majority. So it's going to be more about, it's going to take more than just Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Yeah. But OK, so the problems won't be between you two. It'll be between the third third leg, whatever the third leg is. Is that your expectation?
Well, look, I mean, it's early days yet. Today, okay. Micheál Martin.
And what about Fine Gael? Here is MEP Sean Kelly. And the mood there, well, maybe grins not quite so wide.
We got an unfortunate bounce in the end that we should have been much closer to Fianna Fáil. There's only one percentage point between us, but 8 seats. Mm. So that means that our support
ten seats.
But I mean, there's only one percentage point. So when you look at it from that point of view, almost as many people have voted for us as for Fianna Fáil.
Well, it's the seats that matter in the end, though, isn't it? And I mean, you could point to tactical considerations or whatever you want to on that. But I mean, how do Fine Gael TDs feel about going in as a junior partner with Fianna Fáil?
Well, I wouldn't say we'd be a junior partner. I think the experience of the last 5 years showed that we work very well together.
Don't you junior partner me. And then Sinn Féin, the second largest party. Here's Matt Carthy on their mood.
Determined, I would say.
Maybe, but unlikely to be in government.
I saw a headline today that said the opposition has been voted out. It feels a bit like that, doesn't it?
Well, from our perspective in Sinn Féin, we have more seats in this election than we had
in
the last. Other parties of the opposition increased their seat numbers. If you compare to where perhaps, you know, the commentary would have suggested we would have been a couple of years ago, then, you know, the election wasn't what we would have wanted. But if you compare it to the previous 5 months and to what the commentary was suggesting we would end up in these elections, we had a very good election. And the truth is, we came
into,
and
the
one of the reasons the election was called when it was because people considered, and particularly those in Fine Gael, considered that Sinn Féin were on the back foot, backs against the wall.
From Wednesday's drive time, but at this early stage, no one is really in a committed relationship.
The courtship begins. Who's talking to who?
Kind of seemed like everyone was talking to everybody. A proper mingle party. Labour talking to smaller left-wing parties to forge that common platform. The Sock Dems meeting everyone, keeping their options open. And those independents, well, they're gathering. On Thursday's News at One, Paul Cunningham updated Rachel.
So talk to us then about this group of independents. Who are they and what are they likely to want?
So we have a group of who've declared themselves as regional independents, and that there are 8 of them together, and they are include people like Michael Lowry. Now, he's going to be the interlocutor, the person who's engaging in talks with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They've made it very clear that they are strong, stable and will last the course. And that's something that Michael Lowry has spoken about even before the election. Since the election, we've had Sean Canney and Kevin Boxer Moran, and they point to the fact that in 2016 to 2020, during that administration when the Independent Alliance was there, that they were there through the tough times and also the good. So the mood from the independents is positive. They feel that they are on the inside track, and what they're trying to do is to indicate that they are sort of tough and prepared to take tough decisions. It may be the case, because of speculation, that the outgoing Ciarán Cóirlis, Sean O'Farrell, maybe going back into that job. That would mean one less Fianna Fáil TD, so it's possible that they would require someone else, and maybe one or two independents outside that newly created regional independent bloc.
From Thursday's News at One. And if there was one phrase of the week, it might be parity of esteem. You're great. No, you're great. We're both great. But I'm a little bit greater, let's face it. On Monday, a particularly sparky interview between Claire Byrne and Fine Gael's Patrick O'Donovan, a TD who really did not want to get ahead of himself.
And there are a number of combinations that could potentially come out with the formation of a government, as there were the last time. We're going to take our time, and we'll enter into these discussions as adults, and we won't, as I say, be worried about any particular time frame that the media will set out for us. We'll make sure that a programme for government that is agreed would only be agreed with the Fine Gael values clearly stamped on top of it.
So you're taking a very responsible attitude here. So can I read from that if Fianna Fáil insisted on it, you would be happy to see Simon Harris as Taoiseach for the 5-year term?
Well, I don't know how you managed to extrapolate that, Claire. Now, you're good, fairness to you, but you're not that good, because that's not what I said at all. So how you managed to extrapolate that out of us taking our time and being responsible and making sure that any agreed programme for government would have the Fine Gael stamp on is even a step that Claire Byrne has managed to jump beyond, which you've normally jumped. That's not what I've said. What I said is We'll meet on Wednesday. We have over 20 new people who will all have to have their views listened to from their canvas and from their priorities. And from there, we'll make a decision, and I'm sure the Taoiseach will make a decision then, mm-hmm. with regard to putting forward a team that will enter into negotiations around the programme for government. We're not in that space yet because we still don't have all of our seats filled.
Yeah, well, I suppose I was just asking a straight question, you know, as to whether you would be happy to have Simon Harris in there as Taoiseach for the 5 years, as opposed to being in and out with Micheál Martin as Taoiseach. That's the straight question I'm asking.
No, and I'm giving you a straight answer. And I said, like we said during the election, the Taoiseach said during the election, it's very presumptuous of people to start talking about jobs or anything like that when there isn't even a programme for government.
Also on the line, Thomas Byrne of Fianna Fáil.
Then, on who the preferred partner might be once you get beyond Fine Gael, are you interested in talking to Labour, perhaps the Sock Dems, either or both, or independents?
We really haven't got into this. I know you find it difficult to take and hard to believe, maybe.
Well, I suppose, Thomas and Patrick, what I'm looking for really, I know that you haven't had time to talk about this to your party, but your own view on it.
You're looking for a scoop, Claire, to be fair to you, and you're doing a good job.
Patrick, I'm interviewing, as is my job. My job is to interview you and find out what the next government is going to look like. And Patrick, you're an elected TD. You're a minister. You might be a minister next time. I think people expect that you would have a view on these things.
Look, job respectfully is to talk to our parties first.
Okay, but you've agreed to come on the programme, I'm delighted that you're happy to answer the questions that I'm putting to you. Yes, Thomas, go ahead.
Can I just say, whatever we do, and it'll take time for that to emerge, it'll have to go back to the Fianna Fáil members who've worked so hard to get this election result over the line. So parliamentary parties have to meet.
From Clare on Monday. And our final tetchy exchange is between Cormac and Ona Brin of Sinn Féin, because it ain't over till it's over.
And there are other options there. It doesn't have to be
like what?
A Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael,
what are the other options?
Independents. Well, for example, if those parties don't agree a deal, if parties of the left are able to work together, then there are other options. We always said we would talk to other parties, and that includes Fianna Fáil and others. And therefore, if Micheál Martin wants a right-wing coalition with Fine Gael and with regional independents, that's his choice.
But I thought you had a problem with Fianna Fáil. So you're now pleading with Fianna Fáil to drop Fine Gael. This is almost incredible, Owen, though. I mean, you're pleading with Fianna Fáil, come with us and a few of the parties on the left and we'll bring change. Is that it?
In fact, what I'm saying is what I have said many times on your show before and throughout this election campaign and, in fact, the last campaign. Our preference was always to form a government without Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, with other progressive-minded left-wing parties. But we also said, if the numbers didn't allow that at the end, we would talk to all parties. Nothing new in that. But in the first instance, because this isn't just about the numbers, this is about the policies, this is about delivering real transformational change in our society. So what we're doing is exactly what we said we would do if the numbers fell this way, talking to like-minded parties, seeing what the opportunities are. And don't forget, Cormac, it's early days and things can happen. Surprises can come out of nowhere.
I know, but it's highly unlikely, it seems, at this point. Can I come back to Jennifer Whitmore first?
Can I just say this to you, Cormac? Yeah. In my 32 years in politics, things that are highly unlikely sometimes happen and you need to be properly prepared for them, particularly given the needs of the people we represent on the crucial issues impacting on their lives.
And maybe some people who voted for you would say to you, it's a pity you didn't do that before the voting day or during the campaign. It might be a more coherent offering.
I think the only person who's said that to me so far are journalists like you, Cormac.
I doubt that very much, Owen, and will say.
I'd say I have a better read of my electorate than you do, Cormac.
Well, people
can
let us know to 51551.
Ona Brin of Sinn Féin. And on it goes. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Monday night's arena, celebrating the very best in short fiction from the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, finally, this.
And so, time now to announce the overall winner and the writer who will walk away with the top prize in this year's RTE short story competition worth €5,000. Judge Claire Kilroy will tell us who.
This story was fully realised. In imagining himself with such commitment into his protagonist's shoes, this writer managed the feat of putting his reader into those shoes. The atmosphere, the tension, the sense of dread gripped us throughout. what could have been an ordinary crime story was elevated at the ending by an upsurge of love. For these reasons, and with our congratulations, first prize in the RTE Short Story Competition 2024 in honour of Francis McManus goes to the author Matty Brennan for his short story, Dead Bait.
It is a cracking story, and here is Aaron Monaghan reading an extract from Dead Bait.
I see a gleam of light up ahead, near the turn for the main road. My stomach lurches till I realise it isn't neon blue. It's a vertical stream of pale light, as if someone is shining a powerful torch up to the sky. I slow down, hunch forward, and squint. As I near it, I can make out the shape of a small yellow car, a Fiesta. But it's all wrong. It's on its side, a mess in the ditch. One headlight is shining upwards, the other is smashed in. I lower the window. There's no sound from its engine. I'm at crawling pace now, inching past the wreckage, when I hear a faint cry. Unconsciously, I brake hard, shift into neutral and pull up the handbrake. A hoarse, frail voice is calling out. Help.
An extract from Dead Bait by Matty Brennan, the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition. Do yourself a favour, listen back to the whole thing and the other entrants, all on RTE Culture. You will not regret it. With Ray, the author of Wicked, the origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz. It has morphed from the book to the stage to the screen, now starring Ariana Grande, or as we like to call her.
We call her Ari. She's my dear friend.
Oh, sorry.
Ari, of course. That is Gregory Maguire, and it is his 1995 book that started Wicked. He spoke to Ray, and he was an enormous amount of fun. He had grown up in his very Catholic family watching The Wizard of Oz.
For a child who was pretty much restricted from watching much TV in childhood, my parents disapproved of it, they made the exception for The Wizard of Oz, and therefore the annual broadcast of The Wizard of Oz became a kind of liturgical event in our neighborhood. There was Christmas, there was Easter, there was Good Friday, there was The Wizard of Oz. It was a national holiday of terror, and it took on a kind of scriptural significance.
Yeah.
And for him, there were always moral questions about the man behind the curtain.
And on what stage did you say to yourself, well, you know, the Wicked Witch must have a backstory. She is the way she is for some reason.
Well, I probably started thinking not about the Wicked Witch, but about the Wicked Wizard by the time I was about 10, because one of my brothers says, you were a moral savant, Gregory. You were always trying to puzzle out the right and wrong in people's behavior, including in the behavior of characters in stories. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me, if you remember the 1939 film with Judy Garland, there's a scene in which she comes up and she realizes the wizard is a humbug, and she says, "You're a bad man," meaning you sent me off to the West to kill your nemesis, and you put me in danger while you hid behind this curtain. And he says to her in the movie, "Oh, I'm not a bad man. I'm just a bad wizard." Well, by the time I was 10... watching this, I thought, you know what? That's a load of
baloney.
You are a terrible man, and Dorothy should have kicked you in the you know what, because you did a terrible, terrible thing. That really disturbed me first. But then you kind of work back from that, thinking, well, why, if you were willing to potentially sacrifice a child in order to take out your enemy, what is it that your enemy represents, and why are you so scared of her? And that brought me to the character of the Wicked Witch of the West.
And he also told Ray about the circumstances of his own birth.
I am the middle child of seven,
right?
But the family has the sad history that is now luckily not so common. My mother, my birth mother, who was Greek, died in childbirth when I was born.
When
I was born.
Wow.
I was the youngest one of the first batch, yes, as we called them. And then my father, Maguire, married another Irish woman, McAuliffe,
yeah.
And she and he raised me together. So while my experience of life is as the middle child in a family of seven kids with a mother and a father, the backstory for me is actually quite tragic, and it's amazing that I can speak in complete sentences.
Yeah, how does that impact on you, the fact that you know that your mother died while giving you life?
It was, it has not always been easy. And there's a scene in Wicked, the movie, the musical, and the book, in which Elphaba says to Glinda, "I'm the reason my mother died.
Yeah.
My father didn't want another child to come out green, so he made my mother chew some leaves, and they actually caused my sister to come out handicapped and my mother to die on the childbirth bed." So whenever I get to that point in the story, I have to admit a chill goes up and down my spine, and I think to myself, well, thank you to my mother, thank you to my father, thank you to my stepmother who raised me, for allowing me somehow to be more or less mentally stable.
Yeah.
Interesting. And of course, the name Elphaba is a nod to L. Frank Baum. But in case you're thinking of it, don't.
Now, do you know that not long ago, by that I mean last week, I was signing books in a bookstore, and for the first time in 30 years, a woman came up to me and she said, "I have to tell you, I named my daughter Elphaba."
Oh, no.
And
sorry.
I thought, I've heard of a lot of kittens being called Elphaba and a couple of dogs, but not a daughter. So I said a Hail Mary.
What a lovely man, Gregory Maguire, with Ray. With Oliver, Maggie O'Farrell. Her novel Hamnet is now being filmed with Paul Mescal and Jessie Buckley. But she was talking to Oliver about her children's book When the Stammer Came to Stay. And she talked about how her own stammer had shaped her as a writer.
Obviously, for years, I absolutely hated it. It felt like my enemy, and it felt like something that was trying to, you know, crush the life out of me in some ways. But now, looking back on it now, as a, whatever I am, 52, I can see that I don't think I would have been a writer unless I had also had a stammer. You know, I think if you're a stammerer as a young child, you become incredibly hypersensitive to language and grammar and meaning at a really, really young age, because any stammerer in any conversation is inside their head, you know, redrafting and editing and thinking about the ways to say things. You know, you're looking ahead in a conversation, thinking about what you might be expected to say next. And if that thing starts with a word or a sound that's a problem for you, you're editing yourself and you're thinking, well, I can flip that clause around, I can change a different word, I can think of a synonym. So you're operating on an entirely different level to anyone else who's talking.
Well, that's an extraordinary insight into the machine ticking in someone's head, that you have to give such careful thought to the next word, the next sentence, in the hope that it'll arrive out.
Yeah. Also, you can't overestimate what a joy it is to be able to write and your words just flow.
Yeah. It has definitely helped.
It's like nothing else.
And of course, Maggie O'Farrell was born in Derry. She has an Irish passport. But the relationship, drop-down menu, it's complicated.
You're very aware of your English accent when you're here. Explain that to me now.
Well, I suppose it's just a feeling that it's very hard to decide. You know, I think if you don't grow up in the place where you are born, as I did, you always have this kind of ghost self. You know, you always have that thought, you know, what would have happened if we'd stayed? Who would I have been? There's that other person, if I'd had an accent that matched my passport or my name, for example, you know, what would that have been like? But of course, you know, you never know. But there is that sense of kind of othering in a way, I think. Having our surname in Britain in the 70s and 80s was not an easy thing. You know, there was it was a kind of very strong element of anti-Irish feeling, and relations between the two countries were very fraught at that time. I think it's improved now. I wish I could say that it's because some people are less racist, but I'm not sure that's true. I think just a different community is receiving that sort of negativity. Yes. But yeah, certainly. It's you know, there's a very long and very complicated history between these two countries, and I'm very aware of that. I think one of the interesting things that I find very interesting is that there are, in America, there's a very accepted phrase. You know, you talk about Irish Americans, and it's the same in Australia. There is no equivalent phrase ever used in Britain. No one ever says Irish British or British Irish, which I think is very significant.
Yeah, it is significant, isn't it?
Semantically, it's a very interesting lack.
You could be the first, Maggie. British Irish, Irish British.
That's a really hard thing for a stammerer to say all the way. There's a lot of complicated sounds in there.
It's the B, that's the problem.
And that brings us to this slightly bizarre item on Drive Time.
Irish actors Paul Mescal and Barry Keoghan have found themselves on a list of the most mispronounced words of the year, according to new research. Language learning app Babbel, with the help of the British Institute of Verbatim Reporters, has compiled a 2024 list of the most frequently mispronounced names and words of the year. I'm joined now with the secretary of the British Institute of Verbatim Reporters, Mary Serene. Mary, you're very welcome.
Hello there.
What does your institute do exactly?
Well, we are verbatim reporters. And
verbatim, and maybe that is where it started.
And your job is to get names right in terms of pronunciation. So you're having a bit of a problem across the water with Barry Keoghan.
Yes.
What else is on the list?
You mentioned Paul Mescal.
Paul Mescal.
Strike one.
How do you pronounce the name Colm?
Colm.
Come again?
Colm.
Ooh, that's a no.
I would pronounce the L in it.
Yeah, Colm.
There's an Irish
like Colm McCann,
who was in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Who was Colm Meaney.
Colm Meaney, that's right. Well done.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have said Colm because there's no U in it. I would just have said Colm, not Calm.
Yeah, there's a gobbledge, we call it. A gobbledge, the sunken vowel or whatever you call it in English, I don't know. But there is.
Colm the gobbledges, come on.
How would you pronounce my surname, Mary? I'll spell it out for you.
Now,
small H, big E, A, D, H, R, A.
Janie.
Now, you'll have to start at the beginning again. I've got an M.
H, E.
Oh, H.
Yeah. A, D, H, R, A.
Hedra.
Well, it's better than header, which is what people say. There's another one here that you're very good at giving it an old lash, if I may say so. How do you pronounce C, A, T, H, A, L?
Catchall.
That's Cahill.
Borderline cruel.
That's Cahill. And people are texting us various names that give people difficulty.
Oh, Hedra. Picking on the neighbours. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Things you don't want to see on a motorway and you're probably not expecting.
Three lanes of traffic per evening for driving, rain falling, slightly rain falling, wipers on intermittent, 7:15:20 in the evening. So all of a sudden, the three lanes all moving along nicely at a high traffic time. Traffic stops dead. Cars scrambling to stop and whatever else on the road. No warning whatsoever. I pulled up behind the car and I could see behind me people struggling, and I went in onto the grass margin in the middle of the road, and the car behind me come up inside me there. Luckily, didn't hit anyone. The traffic started to move slowly then. I could see five or six cars length up in front of me, a number of fellas sitting in the windows, out the windows of cars, with their back out, and they filming something in front.
That's Ollie on Liveline, and he was on the N7 near Rathcoole last Friday, and the road was under the control of the sulky racers.
I could see then a horse running up the road, and then it became apparent it was a sulky race that was going on. So these guys come out onto the road and had a sulky race for about 5, 6, 7 kilometres, not sure exactly. And the boys behind were stopping traffic from coming to them. It was all filmed. Obviously, it was a well-rehearsed race, well organised, we call it, other than they didn't take into consideration the traffic. We went under the bridge, one of the crossover bridges there, and the bridge was lined with spectators, and you could see the phones filming what was going on. And that went on for 15, 20 minutes, what, something like that, at full traffic time, an extremely dangerous situation.
And for Joe, it was a mix of ennui and anger.
When the race finished, it looked to finish just past the Dublin side of the Green Isle Hotel along there.
On the motorway, and on one of the busiest motorways in the country.
Yeah, one of the, I can say, there probably was two sulkies in the race that I could see, because I'm back a little bit. One of them went off, the other one proceeded in the middle lane for another kilometre with no one behind them. No, the vans were gone, and there was a car beside him with two fellas, and they were having a full conversation going along the road.
And there's no one to lights, check them. Yeah,
no lights, no warning, anything else.
Bear with me here. Gardaí received a report of an alleged road traffic incident involving sulky racing on the N7 at Rathcoole at approximately 7:20 p.m. on Friday the 29th. Of November, last Friday. Would that be you, the night of the election?
That's us. Okay. Yeah, I didn't make the report for that.
Okay, someone else did.
I was behind that.
Gardaí.
As was hundreds of people in on that road, a busy road.
Now, did they just receive one report? They say Gardaí received. Gardaí attended the scene and conducted a patrol of the area. No relevant parties were located, nor reporting members of the public identified. If anyone has any information and wishes to make a report, please contact the Gardaí in Clondalkin.
Mm-hmm. From Liveline. It's Always Your Bleeding Own is a new play by Thomas Cain Byrne, and he and one of the actors, Erica Rowe, joined Brendan Courtney. And Inner City Dublin is just great on stage, but only if you know what you're talking about.
How sick are you of seeing people up there, like, mutilating their accents and, like, telling our experience as, like, a secondary source, you know? So I was like,
just don't gloss over that, come back into that a little bit. I like that. So you were just sick. I read a great line: you're sick of Arabellas and Funtons doing working class accents and possibly quite badly. So go on.
Just like, I don't know, like Bortes and skirts and stuff like that. And it was like, it just annoyed me, like, that our area was the worst place in the world until they wanted to pull from it. And there's, like, countless things set in the flats by people who've never been in a block of flats in their life, you know what I mean? So, yeah, we just wanted to, as we said, like, our unofficial tagline was theatre by knit bags, for knit bags, about knit bags.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, and making theatre as accessible to the working class people as the cinema.
But breaking out of Dublin, my Dublin, can be tricky.
There's a big judgment with Dublin accents.
Yeah, and I think, especially for working class women, I think working class men can kind of push past that a little bit, because it's kind of sexy to be common when you're a man. But if
common,
you're,
I haven't heard that
I
in
know,
years.
Yeah, but if you're a woman who is common, it's not sexy. It's seen as a little bit dirty sometimes, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And how do you rail against that then professionally? That's kind of amazing. That just, you set up your own company and do it yourself.
Yeah, it's like, if that's the way we're going to be cast, why not make these characters the characters that we know, we love, the people, the voices that we wouldn't usually hear on the stage? Let's do it, and why not?
Have you ever sat through a performance and thought, got angry about it? You don't name
how long is this slot?
And by the way, this is their fix for Dublin City.
Lower the rents, open the clubs, let us have a pop.
Let's put that on t-shirts. Now though, to the latest Healthy Ireland survey, and it turns out we are in pretty good shape. Here's Interim Chief Medical Officer Professor Mary Horgan with Audrey.
So what are the findings? How healthy are we?
Well, the good news is we are very healthy. 81% of the population reported overall good or very good health. And that's a slight increase from last year, which was 80%. And then even better is that 86% of people felt that they had a good quality of life. That's the good news story.
Which is where we'd like to leave it, but no.
And what's the bad news within it?
So I suppose there is an increase in binge drinking, and that's something that we do take seriously.
And is that binge drinking among a certain demographic?
It's mainly in the 20 to 35-year-old age group is where binge drinking would be more of a concern. But it seems to be less of an issue with the older population.
And I see smoking is dropping, but vaping is now on the survey at 8%.
We have noted an increase in vaping and are working on a bill which will contain proposals to restrict the colour and imagery on vaping. We know that vaping does contain a lot of toxic products and is associated with lung disease. So it's really important to get that message across.
Professor Mary Horgan on Morning Ireland. But it is always better and cheaper for our health service to stay healthy. Let's not get sick in the first place, if we can help it. With Clare, Dr. Paddy Barrett, preventative cardiologist at the Blackrock Clinic, and he was doling out some tough love.
So when we see the person celebrating their 100th birthday in the media, and that happens often, and the reporter will say, and what are your secrets to a healthy and long life? Should we pay attention to the answer?
No.
Why?
No, so this is, I think we should always be polite. If you look at the healthy centenarian population, which is our aspirational goal for those who are interested in living longer, healthier lives, the key thing to recognise is that those individuals will die from one of three things. And those three things are the same as everybody else. They will die from cardiovascular disease, cancer or dementia. They do not die from skydiving accidents, their last ascent of K2 or, you know, some other crazy activity. They die from the same thing as everybody else. The key thing is that they get those major chronic conditions 20 to 25 years later than everybody else. Mm-hmm. So the key is that if you focus on the parameters that reduce the likelihood of that happening, so the risk factors, you can push out the timing of the onset of disease. And this is what happens when you are actually doing that at age 50 years of age. If you've hit those healthy metrics, you're delaying the onset of the major chronic disease. And what this is called is morbidity compression. So you compress the amount of time in your life that you have a major chronic disease that is impacting your quality of life and by consequence, the actual healthcare expenditure that goes with it. And the aspirational goal for all of us and all these individuals is to, you know, die by, you know, at age 95 being shot in the back by a jealous lover.
So all those Keith Richards out there swigging whiskey, eating the cigarettes and the rest, well, pure genetic luck.
But if the 95 or the 100-year-old is saying, well, I went for a walk every day and I ate fibre and I didn't drink too much.
But that's rarely what they say. If you look at the literature on these individuals, the healthy centenarian population, and you look at their lifestyle patterns are as bad, if not worse, than everybody else. So the key reason that they live to really these extreme ages beyond 100 years of age is in large part connected to their genetics. So they have a genetic body armour that causes this phase shift in the timing of onset of a major chronic disease. Most of us do not have that genetic body armor. So therefore, we have to use a different approach, but we can use the same model. So if we can say, listen, by changing our behaviors to delay the onset of a major chronic disease, we can at least emulate in a directional sense what the healthy centenarians do. But if you look at the activities that they often propose in terms of the cod liver oil, the apple cider vinegar, the glass of Guinness, the two cigarettes, you know, that relationship is not going to be the case. If you look at Jean Calment, who was the oldest living female, oldest living person ever, who died at 122 years of age, she smoked her entire life.
So it was genetics.
So to a large extent.
And thankfully, no need to be grimacing as you try to stay alive.
Are you in favour of a spoon of full of cod liver oil every day?
I think it's pretty gross.
Right, it is pretty gross, but is it beneficial?
I have limited reason to suspect that it is beneficial. My general take on supplements and things like that is that they're far better. Money is far better spent on things like spending your time outside and getting exercise and activity. Mm-hmm. I think there's not a huge amount of evidence in terms of that supplements and things that you take will add significantly to your health.
So it's very much the basics. It's eating healthily and getting exercise, being outside, having friends.
Correct.
Dr. Paddy Barrett with Clare. But what about horsing fistfuls of mince pies into the gob at the Christmas party? Well, he didn't say not to. But if you are going to be a little bit of a know what you're getting into. With Sarah, nutritionist Heather Leeson.
And I'm sorry now to depress people, but I'm going to impart some of this information. One mince pie, what would you guess?
How much exercise would you have
no,
to do?
No, how many calories?
It's about 250 calories. It's more.
I have 260 here. I suppose it depends on the size of the mince pie.
Yeah, and what you have it with, right?
51 minutes of walking to work off one mince pie, folks. I'm so sorry about this. Christmas pudding, 416 calories. You'd have to walk for 81 minutes. I don't know if that's a whole Christmas pudding or a slice of Christmas pudding, Heather. What do you think?
Yeah, I think like we do always overestimate the amount of, we don't understand how much we have to burn off the food that we eat. So some people might be walking nonstop between now and the 31st of January if they want to burn off the extra stuff that they're eating.
Fa-la-la-la-la, not listening. And of course, we did hit the mince pies last night. It was Toy Show night and Storm Dara, so sitting in was mandatory. We didn't have a choice. But if you are looking for the sweet sugar to end all sugar, we give you the would-be Marys in the Nativity play from Ennis National School, as heard on Our Divine Sparks.
Well, I'd actually want to play the role of Mary because I'd love to ride a donkey. It's because she's a nice person and she's a caring person. And if, like, somebody get hurt, even if she was homeless, she would go and help them back up. And when she had baby Jesus, she would never leave him. Mary has to hold the baby for a long time just in case that she doesn't bang his head.
And what do you think Mary was like as a person?
Well, she was obviously really kind if the angel picked her to get Jesus as the God's son, because she's very kind. It's because she has a good heart.
Oh. What about her dress? Is it really nice?
I like her dress. It's like a white cloak with white pearls on it. It's made out of velvet and cloth. It's elegant and it's pretty.
I would like to be Mary, and you might get to sing a solo, and it would be really fun acting out Mary and pulling the donkey all the way to Bethlehem in Egypt. Well, she says, ah, when she has the baby, and then she tries to take care of the baby, and that's obviously hard work, but it would be fun when you're just acting it out.
Oh, just lost a tooth. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.